Survival Podcast is always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life, if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 2nd, 2026, and this is episode 3864 of the Survival Podcast. And I've got a good one for you today. It's Expert Counsel Show of the Week, because it is a Thursday. And I've got some people we haven't heard from in a while, and I got one we ain't heard in since forever. And I don't mean as in never, I mean it's been a long time. And I actually got a bunch of content in from the council, because I sent out an alert saying, I need more content! And more came in than I need. I already have enough that I could, I need really one more segment next week to be full, but I could do a show next week. So I'm content rich. So if you are an expert council member and you got me an answer and you don't hear it today, you did nothing wrong. I just had to pick and choose. And I gave priority to some people we haven't heard from in a while. Now, my lead story, though, is somebody we hear from almost every week because they almost never miss having a segment for it. So I always play it. And it is Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini with the Liberty Report highlights for the week. And I love this subject because it's not about Iran at all. I think, you know, they've been talking about that a lot lately, and I understand the angle they're coming from and all, and it's the biggest story out there, I guess. But there's other things going on, and there's a lot of talk about socialism. And I'm concerned. I talked about this the first show of this week about my concerns with the left basically taking over things. But their summation, and I agree with it, but everything comes in degrees, is both parties are nothing but a bunch of socialists. Really, are the Republican socialists? Uh-huh. Do they take your money and spend it on programs and then say it's for the greater good? Yeah, that's socialism. Instead of letting the private sector fix problems, they think the government needs to stick their little fingers in everything. They just have a different way of doing it. It's still socialism. So we'll hear from them. Then we're going to hear like something maybe a little more practical on your homestead. Nick Ferguson will talk about the best way to root mulberry cuttings, and he'll do what you often have to do, change the question a little bit to give the right answer or the best answer. Mike Melito will talk about the ins and outs of dry fire exercises, and I'm going to head this off. No, you won't break your gun or damage your firing pin. Yes, those of you have to be nitpicking little assholes like you're at a sci-fi convention asking about episode 37, you know, conflicting with episode 182. Yes, there are some older rimfire guns that this would, you know, possibly cause firing pin issues with. You don't do it with those. But everything else, anything you bought since, like, you were born is not a problem. Anyway, moving on. Matt Sersley will talk about thoughts on selling property to a family member, in this case, a child, right? An adult, really, but like your son or your daughter, and how that can have impacts from a tax consequences issue. Nicole Sauce will talk about why would you ever take a beginner class for a skill you already have? I have some thoughts on this one. And my thoughts, I haven't even listened to her segment yet. We'll listen to it together as I put the show together today. But my thought is because you don't know what you don't know. I think she has a really interesting angle on it, though, because she's a pretty damn good cheesemaker. And she just took a cheese class in Greece. I'm sure that's going to come into it, even though I haven't listened to it yet. And Nurse Amy will talk about putting together a kit of items to get ready for a new baby. I told you we had one here that we ain't heard in since, you know, forever. Maybe forever plus a day. We hear from Doc all the time, but it's Doc Bones and Nurse Amy. And this was a perfect question for Amy, so I kind of siloed it to Amy. And I would like more questions for you guys. You guys know who Amy is and what she's all about. Send me some questions. Nothing wrong with Doc. I got one in the bank for him right now. So, but let's get the lady on a little bit more, because we only have one gal on the expert council right now. That's not by my choice. It's based on volunteers who want to do it and have the qualifications. But technically we have two because Nurse Amy's there, but we don't get specific questions addressed to her area of expertise. Maybe I need to break her out away from Doc on the council list so that she's a standalone. All right. With that, let's go ahead and – With that, before I bring Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on, let's remind you guys about my new book, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life. Right now, as I'm recording this anyway, we are the number one new release in time management. We're like the number six new release in entrepreneurship. That is a cutthroat category. Time management is my layup, right? But to be number one new release on an Amazon bestsellers list for business and then specifically down to the subcategory of entrepreneurship, you're competing with some of the biggest names in the space. When you go there, you're competing with people like Brian Tracy and others. But on the time management thing, what's really kind of cool is releasing the new book is helping to sell the second edition of the older book. And right now on new releases in time management, we are number one with book two, Now Build the System for Your Life. And we are number five for book one, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. So they are both doing really well. If you have not picked up a copy yet, please consider doing so. I poured a lot of work into these, and the second edition of the first book is not a little bit better. It is almost a complete new book in many ways. It is remarkably better, if I do say so myself. And so these would make great gifts, especially to somebody you know that needs a little bit of motivation in their life. Pick up either one. I would really appreciate it. And again, I do recommend that if you're going to get a physical book, that you get the hard cover. And that is because it costs you more, but it's a better experience for you. The quality of the books in the hardcover versus softcover, which comes out of KDP, is dramatic. It'll certainly last longer. It's a book you want to keep around. Nothing wrong with buying the softcover. And the truth is, I make more money if you buy the softcover because the way I'm paid as an author on KDP has to do with printing costs, and then I get a piece of what's left in between there for Amazon to handle the order, which is fine. But because of printing costs of the hard copy and pricing restrictions, I actually make about 50 cents less on one book and 75 cents less on the other. So it's not a big difference for me. I'm just pointing out I'm not telling you to buy the more expensive hardcover because it benefits me. I'm doing it for honest to God for you. I know that sounds like bullshit, but it's not. Another thing, people were a little bit confused about finding book one versus book one first edition. And Amazon makes this all really effing difficult on authors. I just spent an hour with customer support again, and it looks like now, even though it's not what they said, if you were to click on a listing somewhere or a link somewhere for the first edition, it will redirect you now to the second edition. It seems like they've done that. They also promised, again, to move the reviews over, which I do not see happening yet. Please do me a favor. If you've purchased either of these books, including the first edition of the first book, please consider posting reviews for me. I really need some reviews. The books are doing well. They're hitting these bestseller lists and all. And I understand wanting to wait till you actually read the book before you review it. But a lot of you have read the first book. You like the first book. You know the second edition is just the first book and better. If you would please give me some reviews, I would really appreciate it. Including, hey, I think this book sucks. That's okay too. I mean, I don't want you to do a fake review. But if you like what I do and you want to help me out, you know, give me that 5-star review. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on how both parties, yes, both parties are nothing but a bunch of socialists. I would tell you at this point, the three biggest parties in the country are nothing but a bunch of socialists, including, yes, 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 the official LP Libertarian Party. Not Libertarian Principles, but the Libertarian Party has turned into a bunch of woke socialists too. It's kind of a mess, but they're going to talk about the two primary parties.
But there was a headline here in a newspaper in New York and Britain, socialism is on the march. And boy, you can read some stories because, you know, it looks like the socialists have done well in the Democratic primaries. And it's been said that some of those districts that they are talking about are automatically Democrat in the general election, so that there's going to be changes in the Congress and who knows in the various offices on down. So it isn't just a couple people. It isn't just Bernie Sanders hanging around saying, yeah, in secret, have people know I'm a socialist and that sort of thing. No, it is on the march.
I hate to say it, but they're all socialists, with the exception of maybe a few people you could count on one hand. They're all socialists in D.C. And we've said many times throughout this year and a half of this second administration that the Trump administration's policies are so bad that he's rolling out the red carpet for the leftist version of socialism. You know, and President Trump went to his Truth Social. He said, the communists are finally making their move. I've been waiting and preparing for this for a long time. It's easy to be a communist. All you have to do is say, I'll give you everything. But that means you're taking it away from others that have earned it, end quote. He's basically describing himself. That's exactly what President Trump has done. I'll give you everything. Not only does he do that, he does that for foreign countries. I'll give you everything to foreign countries. All our stuff, all our money, hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, so this is something different. Now, the left has their own wrapper, their own flavor to their socialism, but it's no different in principle than what we have with the Republicans. And even Thomas Massey pointed this out. He goes, Republicans decrying communist involvement in a Democratic Party just look the other way when this administration nationalizes ownership of private companies, 10% of Intel, 15% of MP Materials, and he goes on and names others. So they're all socialists in America, unfortunately. They just wrap it up differently. One thing that President Trump, was expert at, is using propaganda to get votes for his form of socialism. Make America great again. Boy, did that sell. So he was expert at that, but we didn't get it. He's not making America great again. It's just a battle of two socialists, and it's, you know, sometimes you wonder if it's even a battle.
So my view on this is they're dead on right. They are all socialists. I would say even some of the people we try to say aren't socialists, like the ones on the one hand that Chris wrote, some of those are socialists too. They're just such socialist light that compared to everybody else, they look completely non-socialist. And I'm sure there's somebody listening to us go, Jack, but basically what you're saying is anything that takes any money in taxes and does anything for the public is a socialism. Yeah, I actually agree with that, but that's not the angle I'm coming from here. Okay, like my schools and my roads, okay, those are actually public goods. Okay, do I think it could be done better in a private system? You bet your hairy ass I do. I really, 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 really think it could be done better. However, okay, that doesn't mean that I'm going to just blanket call all that socialism, even though technically it is. No, I'm going to tell you, I think that socialism, like many things, comes in degrees. And how socialist you are is how we measure those degrees. So if you take something like pure communism, like Soviet-era communism or Mao's communism in the Great Leap Forward, and you call that a 10 of 10 out of socialism. And then you would call something like Dr. Ron Paul a 1 on the complete opposite, that the vast majority of people in our government sit firmly around a 7. And it doesn't matter which side of the equation that they're on, they're firmly, but what they want to do with their socialism is actually important, because as bad as it all is, some of it's worse than others. All of it leads to bankrupting a country's treasury. That is eventually what always happens. However, not all of it directly destroys lives immediately. Where when you get closer to like that 8-9, and I would put like an AOC at like a 9-5, it's some of these retards that just got nominated for the Democrat side of the House in New York are a 10. They might be a 10-5. Okay, they are to the left of an AOC. Okay, I'm just telling you, if you go listen to, like, these people actively hate the country they are running for office to lead. Okay. I mean, literally, like, hate the country on the record, basically hating America for existing and feeling we need to be punished for our very existence while they seek high office in the land. That's how bad these people are. And so the sentiment that what's happening is dangerous can be separated from the sentiment that Dr. Paul and Chris here. And I said a 7. Okay, let's say somewhere between 5 and 7, depending on who we're talking about. But, like, this is not just you people that are, you know, blanketly labeled neocons. Like, I'm talking about the majority of the mainstream GOP are still sitting at, like, a 5. The danger to me, though, isn't so much that they are socialists. It is people now fully embracing the term. It is one thing for the average dupe, and they are the average dupe, to be like, I'm voting for this person, or I'm voting for that person. And you say, are they a socialist? No, no, no. And they're wrong. Okay, that is an error in judgment of what you're voting for, right? But when the person says, I know they're a socialist. I want socialism. Socialism is great. This is an error in cognitive function because you literally can't point somewhere where this type of full-on class warfare socialism was ever employed that did not result in misery and eventually death. And yet you're choosing it openly. And this is what I was talking about earlier this week. When people get to the point where they're like, I just can't get anywhere. And it's everybody's fault but mine. That's why they have drilled that into your thick ass, your thin ass skulls, actually, Gen Zoomer. Okay? They have drilled that into you because this is what they want from you. They want you to be a useful idiot and help overturn 250 years of history, despite our flaws, of being the best bet there has ever been for humanity. That's what they're doing. And that's what their goal is. And they convince you the boomers took it all. When 60% of the boomers live below the frickin' poverty level, and less of you live below the poverty level than the boomers who supposedly took all your shit. This doesn't make any sense. And it is very, very dangerous. And I do have a question because I've gotten some feedback from some of you guys in like that 20 to 30 year range about my comments about the guy that wrote me this long ass letter from my Tom Woods interview and the Zoomers. And you just want us to pull us up by our bootstraps. And he's like trying to explain their positions. And there's 3 different people in addition to that guy. So 4 total long ass emails. And I look at these emails and I think, first of all, I don't know what you're saying because you use too many words. You're not just bluntly stating what you actually want because you don't know what it is, mainly. You're not stating whether or not you actually take responsibility for it or not because you don't want to. But I just would wonder if any of the people that sent me that, I'm talking like multi, because obviously I didn't read them all. If you're going to email me grievances, accolades, whatever, I don't care what it is. You want me to read it, it better be in like 3 or 4 sentences and it better be clear or I'm done. But I can look at the totality, scan it, get the feeling for it, and think, is there anything you've done in your own life for your own benefit in the last month that required the effort that it did to write me an email and bitch because I didn't commiserate with you in your experience? And I know already what the answer is. No, you didn't. And I don't mean something your boss made you do. Well, I work really hard. That's not what I'm talking about, and you know it. Have you applied the effort to improve your own position in life that you put into emailing me and crying about your life? And the answer is no. You are the people they're selling this to. And it will not work. Your position will not improve if this continues. It will worsen because it always has. And no, this time is not different. Okay? This is another person sticking a fork in an electrical outlet and telling you it's okay. I know everybody else that ever did this got hurt, but they did it wrong and I know how to do it. And look at the people. These people that are subtarded, I won't even use the R-tard word, right? They are subtarded that are leading this charge. They have an IQ of a turnip, and that's being generous, and you think they can fix one of the most complex problems in history just by, we'll tax the rich. Like nobody ever thought of that before. But whatever, I digress. That's almost an extra segment for me this week. But I'm telling you guys, yes, they're all socialists, but the level of socialism does matter as to how much damage can be done, especially in the relative near term, rapid change where there's not time for adaptation. All right, moving on. Let's talk about rooting mulberry cuttings and listen to a master teacher change the question a little bit so they can actually be answered properly.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question from Ryan Steva, the homestead consultant, on mulberries. Nick, what is your favorite way to root mulberry cuttings? Details. I have a black mulberry tree of unknown cultivar that is the most prolific and tasty fruit production mulberry I've ever come across. I need to do major trimming after this season, and I would like to propagate as many of the cuttings as possible. What time of year and propagation method do you prefer, and are there any runners up? What about hardwood versus softwood and time of year to attempt? Okay, well, I want to answer your question how you asked it, but I have a feeling I should be answering a different question. Because if you're actually talking about black mulberry, Morris nigra, which is not native to the USA, it's actually like a Mesopotamian mulberry, kind of a Middle Eastern, Iran type region. It's not very hardy in Tennessee. So like zone 7 is pushing it. It's more of a tropical. So I kind of doubt it's a Morris nigra black mulberry. But I'm just going to answer it as if it is black mulberry. So if you are actually talking about a black mulberry and you just don't know what cultivar, then I'd say you should be taking dormant first year cuttings around pencil diameter with 2 to 3 buds and using a whip and tongue graft onto a same diameter rootstock of Morris alba or white mulberry. If you want to try and get it growing on its own roots, which would be really cool, then after it grows for a couple years, I would girdle the scion right above the graft union in winter, apply rooting hormone around 6,000 ppm IBA to that girdled portion, and bury that, and that'll get it growing on its own roots. So you cover that girdle with potting mix, and you put a collar around it just to kind of raise the soil level up, and then once it's rooted well, you can just cut it loose of the white mulberry rootstock. Typically you're going to want to let that grow for a couple of years before you try and cut it loose and transplant it. Or you can use a copper wire in the same spot right above the graft union, just kind of crank that copper wire down to girdle it, and you bury that girdle wire portion, and that'll dwarf the tree. Should keep it around 12 foot tall rather than the 30 they'd normally reach. That is what Dr. A.J. Bullard, Eliza Greenman, talked about that on her Eliza Apples blog. So look that up. Really cool. If it is a red mulberry, Morris rubra, that's the native USA mulberry, or some hybrid with white, which happens a lot, actually. So I'm guessing that's actually what you're talking about. A lot of people tend to call the red mulberry a black mulberry just because the berries are dark purple to black, but they're not actually black mulberries. So if we're talking about Morris rubra or possibly even a hybrid, then to be honest, I would do the same thing. If it's just a great cultivar, you don't know what it is, and you're just trying to copy that a few times, try grafting it onto white mulberry rootstock. It's really simple, really easy. If you're intimidated by that, you can also try to air layer it this summer and see if you can get a handful of rooted specimens that way. None of these methods are going to like churn out a whole bunch of propagated specimens. I think you would probably have the most success if you're trying to add this to like your nursery or something, is to get a bunch of scion wood, a bunch of rootstock, and do some bench grafting, where you're just going to kind of churn them all out, and then you're going to pot up those bench grafts and then grow those out for a couple of years and then sell them. But if you're doing the air layering, shoot for around 2,000 ppm IBA to 4,000. I think the 3,000 ppm IBA would be a nice, good sweet spot. The problem is a lot of these hybrid and native red mulberries, they just don't root all that well. Some of them do, some of them don't. It's going to be really spotty. Most of the literature I can find, the best I've seen is like 60% with really good conditions. So white mulberry does great from cuttings. So graft those natives and hybrids onto white. Kind of a short answer, but it's pretty straightforward. If you want to get on one of the consulting tours this summer, send me an email with consulting in the subject line to nick@homegrownliberty.com. If you have in the past month and haven't gotten a response, I encourage you to bump me again. If you don't get a response this week, your email might have gotten missed or spam foldered. I'm working through requests currently. It's just been a super busy month for us. I just spent all day replacing a hot water heater, and we've been doing some family travel for the last week and a half, 2 weeks. And I was house-sitting for Jack and Dorothy. My parents finally got to meet our new baby girl. Thanks for all the support, everyone. This winter, spring, it's been really rocky for me with the new baby, not having my main helper and my wife, but I'm starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it doesn't sound like a train anymore. So, yeah, for those of you asking and wondering, the baby girl is fat and happy, 3 months old, 17 pounds. She's huge. She's the picture of health. Katie is also doing great. Keep the questions coming. Happy growing and do good things.
All right. Well, next up, let's hear from Mike Melito from Good Shepherd Training on doing some training that's really inexpensive to do. Very, very effective, develops a great deal of muscle memory, and preserves a perishing skill. And that training is called dry fire training, and it's exactly what it sounds like.
Hey, TSP. Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast, here for a firearm segment on the TSP. The importance of dry fire. Dry fire, dry fire, dry fire. I got a request from Jack for some content, and guess what I was just out doing? Dry firing. Why? Because it's important. Because shooting marksmanship is a perishable skill. Let me tell you a story to drive this point home. I'm blessed to be a fairly accomplished competition shooter, state rifle and pistol champion a few times over. I had shot and gotten first place in a qualifying match. I forget if it was local or state level. And then I was assigned in the military to a training school. This training school was not like a combat training school. This was a different kind of school. And ironically, the one place you can't have a firearm, at least at the time, was a military base. It was a temporary assigned duty. We weren't going to be assigned firearms. It wasn't a firearm school. So I was not able to have an actual firearm. So I went to Walmart, and I forget if they were like pellet rifle, air rifles, or airsoft guns. It didn't matter. They weren't firearms. And for the time that I was there, after our normal duties, I dry fired. It's all I could do. Well, forget if it was the day or the day after, I flew back. I shot a match having only, now my gun was already zeroed, all that stuff was already worked out, right? I was familiar with the gun. But it was the day or the day after I flew in, there was the West Coast Regional Championship for this competition. And I shot, and by God's grace, I won. West Coast Regional Champion. Everything up from Mexico up to Alaska and over to, I forget if it was like Montana, that entire western region, having only dry fired in that interim period. That should illustrate how effective dry fire is. If you look at top professionals, military, law enforcement, one thing you'll see is that they dry fire. Dry fire is important. It may not be as cool. It may not be as fun as going out to the range and, you know, dumping a brick of 22 ammo or shooting a bunch of Tannerite or, you know, basically turning money into noise. And there's nothing wrong with that if you just want to do that as a recreational activity to have fun. But just because you are doing that in no way means that you're getting actual meaningful training. There is a time for live fire. There's a time to zero your gun. Make sure it's zeroed. There are skills that you need to drive, that you need to live fire for, rather. But there are absolutely times when it's as good or better to dry fire than to live fire. The fundamentals of marksmanship, you know, stance, grip, sight alignment, sight picture, trigger control, breath control, follow through. These things can all be done dry fire. Usually better dry fire because you're not distracted by the actual gun going off. Shooting is a very simple process. Now, that doesn't make it easy. A lot of things are simple, but they're not easy. It's simple for me to tell you how to run a marathon. You probably already know how to run. Just do that for 26.2 miles and you've ran a marathon. That doesn't make it easy. Shooting, if I boil it down to the simplest thing, put your sights on the target you want to hit and hold them there through the firing cycle and make the gun go off and don't move them. Ta-da! You do that, you will be an expert shooter. Super simple to explain, not easy. To do that requires discipline and dedication and a lifelong commitment to the art and the science of shooting. And a lot of repetitions. Now, even if you have a blue sky budget and you have Uncle Sam buying your ammo, you're still probably going to want to dry fire because some things are better ironed out in dry fire. However, most of us don't have that, and ammunition cost is a real thing. One of the most basic forms of dry fire is just that, holding your sights on target and keeping them there through the firing cycle. And if you were dry firing, let's say, a handgun or a rifle other than off a bench, and you're honest with yourself, most shots are imperfect. If I'm teaching a new shooter and I'm dry firing with them and I ask them what happened with your front sight, and like, oh, it didn't move. I ask them again and they're like, oh, it didn't move. That means they're not paying attention, or they're blinking, or they're actually shutting their eyes when they fire, because most of the time when I do it, it moves. Now, it may be a minute amount, it may be a hair width of that front sight moving up, down, left, right, but it almost always, 9 times out of 10, even for me, it will move. So you need to be paying attention, knowing where that sight moves. But that is a major part of dry fire, just holding the sights on target through the firing cycle and making sure they don't move. Whether that's a front sight or a red dot or a reticle, that really doesn't matter for this. That is like the bulk and the core and the foundation of your shooting, whether it's, you know, a rifle or a handgun. But you can do a lot more with dry fire. If you're trying to work on a fast draw, that generally doesn't mean moving really, really fast. It means ironing out all the superfluous movement, all the unnecessary movement out of your draw stroke to get the gun from where it's stowed to getting the sights on target and pressing the trigger as quickly as possible. Guess what? You can do that dry fire. You can usually do it better because you're not distracted. If you're trying to shoot on the move or learning to shoot on the move, you can do that dry fire. Once you know what a proper sight picture is for a certain sight and a certain weapon and a certain distance on a certain target, you'll know generally whether that shot is acceptable or unacceptable. Like if you're going to sight it in and the sights are on target when that trigger snaps, then you would have hit that target, you know, in general, unless you have some weird thing going on with the gun. So all those other skills, you can practice dry fire. Yes, it can be monotonous. Yeah, it's not the most fun ever. Again, if you just want to go to the range and dump a brick of 22, there's times to just have fun and do that. But if you want to be dedicated to being a rifleman, good at pistol craft, dry firing should be part of your repertoire regularly. The good news is, except for the time you invest in it, you probably already have the equipment. It's basically free. Now, most modern, because I know this comes up a lot, most modern centerfire firearms are perfectly safe to dry fire. Got some old NOSERP thing, maybe double check it. But again, pretty much all modern centerfires are good to go dry firing. Rim fires, you got to check. I know that the Ruger, like the Ruger 10/22, the Ruger Mark IVs, those are fine to dry fire. Other rim fires, you may need to double check. It's had something to do with the firing pin and it hitting on the barrel. But double check on the rim fires, but pretty much any modern center fire, you're good to go. And I hope this encourages you to dry fire. Obviously, right, follow your safety rules, follow your firearm safety rules. If you injure yourself or somebody else, it's your fault. It's not my fault. It's not Jack's fault. It's your fault. There's the public service announcement. Anyway, with that, hopefully you get out there and get some dry fire in. Thanks for listening and have a blessed day.
My additions will be, number one, this is one of the most valuable forms of training you can do. Especially do some of the things that Mike said. Additionally, I have several exercises that I do and I teach people when I'm working with them. And there's actually some very old Fat Jack videos in the MSB. of me doing some dry fire exercises and going over things like head alignment, head positioning with scopes, etc. And I think this is one of the most underutilized forms of training that we have. It's very inexpensive, obviously, because it doesn't really cost anything. And I think a lot of it does hang on this myth that somehow you're going to damage your weapon by dry firing. And it's just not the case. You know, in the United States Army, do you know how much of your BRM week is spent doing dry fire exercise? Probably half of it, including what's called the dime or washer exercise, where you have a buddy while you're in whatever shooting position you're in, balance a dime on the barrel and you slowly pull the trigger and see if it falls off. You can get really, really good at that. And you can still not be perfect. That is not a guarantee. Anyway, follow some of his stuff. Follow some of the my dry fire exercise. Develop your own. But don't be afraid to do it. And yes, if you have a 1911 rim fire, maybe it's a problem. But you know what? That's not what nobody's telling you to do. And you know it. So get out there and do some dry fire. And next up, let's talk about selling a property to a child and why you would do it. And let's hear what Matt has to say about it from a tax implementation. I have not listened to this yet. I'm going to listen. And I have some ideas, but I'm going to make sure he didn't cover it before I go lipping off.
Hey, TSP. This is Matthew Searsley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to answer another listener question. This is from Alan, and it's about selling property they own to their son. Was told there are tax implications if we sell it too cheap. Is this true? And any suggestions? Some more information. We looked at selling in the past, and we're told we would need to get an appraisal and sell it at market value to a family member. That I could sell it to others for whatever I wanted and be considered stupid, but if I sold too cheap to family, we could have tax issues with the IRS, etc. The value of the land has gotten stupid, and basically it's worth a lot more than what they paid for it, and they don't want to charge family that. Do I need a separate appraisal? Should I use the tax assessment? Should I just sell it for whatever I feel like? Any other ideas? So yes, this is a common question. And first of all, the big question I always ask is, why do you want to sell the property to your son? Typically, tax-wise, you're going to be far better off. They're going to be far better off if they wait for you to die and they inherit it. And that's because under current tax law, when you die, the basis of your capital assets is reset to its value as of your death. And so if it's worth $25,000 today, but worth $100,000 when you die, he'll get it with the basis of $100,000. And then if he wanted to sell it, he would be able to, you know, sell it for $100,000 and owe no tax on that. Now, the primary reason that matters is if he is going to be selling this someday, if this is some sort of, you know, family ranch or something that it's never going to be sold, it's going to be passed on, that typically doesn't matter. But yes, there is the separate example for when you are selling to a close family member, and typically this is parents, siblings, cousins, children, grandchildren, or in-laws of the equivalent of those. And what the IRS will say is if you sell something for way, way, way cheaper than it's worth, then the price you sell it to them is their basis in it, and then you need to file a gift tax return for the remaining because it was a gift. So again, if it's worth $100,000 now, you sell it for $25,000 to your son. His basis in it would be $25,000, but you just gave him a $75,000 gift, and you need to do a gift tax return. Usually, for most people, that's no additional tax owed. It just reduces your tax-free inheritance amount. But it is, frankly, kind of a pain in the butt to deal with. It can also, again, if he does sell it in the future, it gets a lot trickier to potentially prove what the basis is. It can get issue. I've seen issues where, you know, the IRS has actually come back and said, no, you said it was one value, but, and you did this gift amount, but you gave it, you know, that was the wrong value, and now that has tax consequences on him selling it. So yeah, it really is a good idea to get an appraisal The tax assessment is not going to be sufficient. Tax assessments, they're evidence, but they're not hard evidence, and the IRS is pretty much going to ignore that. So, the best thing to do is, and it's weird, but at some point even it still involves a gift, but you might be much better off giving your kid the money and then having him buy it from you for full price, than for you to have him pay a lower price and then give him that remaining value. Now, of course, when he buys it from you, you may owe capital gains, you may have capital losses depending on the value of the land when you bought it and what you sell it for. But that's, you know, just kind of part of the thing, which is, again, another reason why if there's not a real need for him to be the owner for some reason, oftentimes you're just better off letting him use the land. You can even do something like give him what's called a life estate, so he has an ownership right in the land and the use of his land. Sometimes that's not going to work. If he's, you know, going to be building a house on it and needs a construction loan, they're not going to want to give a loan. So that is the type of situation where it's not optimal for tax reasons, but it might be the best thing for you to do for other reasons with your family. Well, thanks for the question. Other listeners, if you have any questions, please send them to Jack, and I will get you an answer as soon as I can. You can check out what I do and actually schedule a call with me if you go to agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. Have a great week.
So Matt hit on it at the end there with the idea that maybe the reason that the land needs to be sold is so that the offspring here can obtain a construction loan to build a house, because a lot of these most banks are not going to give you a loan to build a house on property that you cannot show that you have ownership of, right? And they certainly won't consider it in the asset value of the property once completed in the loan to value ratio. Like there's a lot of issues there. So if that's the case, then there probably needs to be some form of a sale here. Some of the advice I would give, now I'm not an attorney, and I would worry less about, well, how much tax am I going to have to pay when I sell the property? I would start worrying a lot less about that one, because if you're even doing this, then I have to believe there's either long-term intentions with it, or maybe they want to develop it and then sell it at a profit, and you're going to pay freaking tax on the profit. So that would be like anybody else. But I would say that if you get rid of that problem, and let's say this is a property that if you had an appraisal done on it would be a $100,000 property, but it currently is being taxed by the municipal authority based on a specific value that they assigned to it, that number would be a pretty damn safe number. So what I'm saying is, like, a lot of us get tired of our tax bills. But a lot of times when you look at a property that's been in one set of hands for a very long time, and it's not a rural property with a 3-2 or a 4-2 on it or something like that, or a McMansion, they don't. A lot of tax authorities don't stay real big on continuously increasing the assessed value. And the reasoning as to, well, why did you pay, you know, $41,000? That was the governmental assessed value of the property, so my father sold it to me for the assessed value, is a damn good answer. Yes, if you then sell that property at a very large profit, yeah, you're going to pay tax on the profit. Wham! That is a good problem to have, you know? And there's always ways to work a tax situation in the future if you know you're heading into it. So that would be just kind of one thing that I would point out about this. And that is, the reason for the sale is so the son can build, and I would get that. Okay, there's another reason, though, the father may want to sell the property. The father may be, you know, near end of life or middle of retirement and needs some more money. And the father may not want the expense of the taxes on the property, and he may want the cash flow from the property. If that's the case, then that is the angle at which you need to look at the problem. And I'm not going to give you a specific answer because I'm in very speculative mode here. Okay, but in that instance, the purchase may make sense because the dad needs the money and wants the money. Another option might be, though, that if the irritation for the father is that he's paying property taxes on this, you could do a lease purchase agreement. And if you do that, the payments that come in, if they're equal to the property tax, the father then should be able to, you check with your CPA and exact situation, because I don't know, but should be able to deduct that as an expense, and therefore the income is zero. And if the son has the capability of building on the property and now is funding the cost of the taxation, the problem is solved. I think what I'm saying is I don't believe we've correctly and fully defined the issue here. We've only asked about one solution without enough context to know the root cause of the question. So this would be a good one to resubmit, and either me, Matt, or somebody else might have some different angles on it. On that, I want you to know something. The question that Nick Ferguson answered earlier, that actually came from Ryan Steva. I think he heard him say that. Well, Ryan sent a bunch of questions because he knew I needed content for other expert council members. If you're an expert council member, flip it, I love this. Let's start having expert council members ask other expert council members questions. You can send them direct if you know the person well. If not, send them to me. I'll be the gatekeeper. I don't mind. Anyway, moving on from there. Let's go ahead and talk about why you might take a class on something, like a 101 entry-level class on something, of a subject you actually know fairly well already. Why would you do such a thing?
Well, hello, TSP. Nicole Sotts here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast with an expert segment about learning. Yep, you heard me right. We're going to talk about learning today. And what got me to thinking about this, and I want to share with you what the lesson is, but what got me to thinking about this was I took a cheesemaking class in Greece. Yeah, I did. I'm the person who teaches Curds and Connection here at the Holler Homestead once a year, which is all about making cheese. So I'm an expert. Why should I take a class? We'll get into that. If you want to keep building a better life and keep making your world better around you, it's important to learn something every day. Learning is the foundation of keeping things going and making improvements over time. Plus, you know what? If you keep your brain engaged, you live a happier, healthier, longer, better quality life than if you just give up and just stop learning. And we've all seen it, right? In people who are like, I'm done, I'm out. And then they stop learning and then they literally are out, usually not very long after that. So if you want to protect your future and build, I think lifelong learning is a state of being that is well worth pursuing. So this brings me to something I've noticed about people and learning and classes. We have a lot of folks in our network who do things like pig processing or meat curing or ham radio classes or any number of different things you can learn, which are just fascinating. Even just starting a fire, learning how to start a fire. Yeah, you know how to start a fire, but do you know how to start a fire the way Fred starts a fire? Take Fred's class. What I've noticed is when you have an area of expertise and you take all the advanced classes and you've learned all the things you can think of and you're constantly YouTubing to learn more, sometimes it's well worth it to go back and take a beginning level class. Case in point, I teach processing classes for chickens here at the Holler Homestead about once a year, which is to say I've processed a fair number of chickens. So when I had the chance to take Joel Salatin's class on processing chickens, I was like, well, you know, it's cool because I'll get to talk to Joel, but what am I going to learn? Well, let me tell you what I learned. I learned a whole bunch about marketing and packaging your chickens in ways that help them sell better. I learned about market trends that he was experiencing. I learned how he tracks his costs per chicken. I learned how he trains people on his farm and pays people on his farm to process chickens when he brings in help. And as a matter of fact, I learned a couple of things about processing chickens I'd never done before that I have adopted into my chicken processing class. Well worth the input, but why would I take it a beginning class? Well, that's why. Because every time you take a class, you learn something new. Likewise, I took a sheep processing class over at Strong Roots Resources. And the dispatch method was what got my attention because they don't use guns. And that was really important. I learned that part. But I also learned a whole bunch about how to handle the meat afterwards that makes it taste even better that I had not learned in other processing classes. I learned the role of blood in the body from the veterinarian who taught his class. That was pretty fascinating. I learned some things about nerve endings and where nerves are on animals that I did not know, as well as how the circulatory system of the sheep works. Now, why would I want to know that? Well, it helps me later when I have a sheep sick, which did happen about a month after that, to know where the blood flows. So when I'm giving shots, I have a good idea of what to do with that. So the other cool thing about taking sort of entry-level classes, even in an area that you have done it, is that it gives you information sometimes that you can apply to other things. Which brings me to my last example. I took a cheese class in Greece. And I knew when I saw what they were doing like for cheeses that it was more about tasting the cheese than how to make the cheese. And then they served a lunch with it. It was like a resort thing. But I also had met the chef and I could tell he had a teacher's heart. So I thought, well, I'll take this. And here's the thing. They took milk. And they curdled the milk, and they drained the curds from the whey, and they made a soft cheese. And then they talked about what would happen if you took that cheese and pressed it for like half a day. It's a different cheese. And then they talked about what happens if you salt the cheese and age it for a week. It's a different cheese. And then they talked about what happens if you then wax that cheese and age it for 6 months. And I thought, well, that was brilliant. And then we got to taste all the different kinds of cheeses from the same kind of milk, same process, and the only difference was how they aged it, how much they pressed it, how much liquid they expelled from the cheese. And what that taught me was that while I do cover all those processes in my cheese class, it was a brilliant innovation to simplify. And by simplify, I mean they just did one cheese all the way through from one kind of milk and one way of making curds. And they did not do different cheeses from different countries. So when I've typically done cheese classes, it's like you'll do a Chev, you'll do a Paneer, two different countries, right? This was just all Greek cheeses, different Greek names, made from goat's milk. We did end up with a feta at one point. Like, you cut it up and put it in a brine, and then it's feta, right? So that was what opened my eyes to, yep, it is well worth the investment to take an introductory course. So why am I giving an expert segment on the Survival Podcast about this? Because you can take classes right now from people in our community who are great teachers. You can do it online. You can do in-person classes. We have them at the Holler Homestead. If you want to find out about those, that's livingfreeintennessee.com. And the value isn't just that you've learned something new. The value could be that you've sharpened your sword for what you're offering in your life if you are teaching something. And if not, you've sharpened your sword in integrating practices into your house that are making your life better. So get out there, learn something, and make it a great week.
Okay, I have some add-ons there, and it comes down to, again, and I think she didn't say it, but she just explained it perfectly. You don't know what you don't know. So when you take a class on, like, how to make cheese or how to process a chicken or whatever, you're like, I've done loads of this. And even if it's a beginner's class, you don't know what you don't know. And you know what you've been taught, and you know what you've figured out. And sometimes there's better ways, different ways, or interesting ways to approach the same situation that you'll only find out through other people. Here's a story that illustrates this. I believe when I heard this, it was from a preacher or a priest or something, but it fits this perfectly, even though it's a totally secular situation. The story goes, this guy comes home, and his wife has cooked a roast, a pot roast. And they sit down to eat it, and it's delicious like it always is. You know, it's got lots of beef juice and carrots and potatoes. It's all soft. It's been cooked beautifully. And he says, honey, you know, I really like your pot roast, but I've noticed something. You always cut one end off the roast and then put the two ends in the pot together. Why do you do it that way? I'm not complaining. I don't understand why you do it that way. And she says, you know, I don't know. Mom always did that. So they call mom, they call grandma, you know, and she says, well, I don't know either. Your grandma always did it that way. You know, grandma's old, she's still around. So they call, you know, great grandma, and they say, great grandma, mom said that you always cut the end off the roast. And then she did, and now I do, and I'm just wondering why you do that. What effect does it have? She goes, oh, that has nothing to do with the roast or how it comes out. My pan wasn't big enough to fit the whole roast in, so I had to cut it in half. And so this method had been handed down for two generations, but the reason behind it did not exist anymore. The pan that the mom had and the pan that the daughter had were more than sufficient to fit the roast. Now, I have literally sat with people working on an Excel spreadsheet, and I am an Excel ninja. I'm going to tell you, I can do some shit with Excel with financial modeling or business unit modeling and shit that will blow your minds. I've still sat next to somebody else, somebody maybe under me in an organization that reported to me, and saw them throw some sort of shortcut or something. And I went, well, what would you just do? Show me what you did and why you did it. And I've had an employee that thought I was getting on their ass. And I'm like, no. That was cool. I want to explain to me why you did it that way. And now I can take that technique or that shortcut and I can move it into my toolkit. So you can take a class that you know damn well. I could teach a class on this and you can still learn. The depth of layers within all the subjects that we focus on here is extreme. You know, right now I'm putting together the workbooks for my Laws of Life series, and I'm going, damn, I didn't know that I had all that in there. I mean, really, you start to find those layers when you start to pull things apart. And one great way to pull things apart, which in this case would be pulling apart your preconceptions, is go watch somebody else do the same thing you think you know how to do already. With that, I want to go ahead and move on to our next topic, which we'll be hearing from someone we just ain't heard from in quite a while, Nurse Amy, on putting together an OB kit for someone that's going about to have a new baby and hasn't had a baby in the house for, well, I guess haven't had a baby, hasn't gone through the process of having a baby for about 10 years. So they know some things are different and there's some new things available.
Hi, this is Amy Alton from doomandbloom.net or youcanuse.com. I'm a certified nurse midwife, an advanced registered nurse practitioner, co-owner of altonfirstaid.com, and co-author of The Survival Medicine Handbook, which you can find at altonfirstaid.com. I got a question that Jack sent me from Jed, and he says, what must-haves for a new baby? A lot has changed since my last kid 10 years ago. What newer life-saving devices and quality of life devices should be our priority as we are welcoming a new little one into our home? I see items like the airway clearance device, and it makes me wonder if that or other new devices are necessary or at least greatly beneficial in my kit. Thanks, Jed. Well, I want to talk a little bit about an emergency that you could have if you are on your second, third, fourth, or several kids. Sometimes you go into labor, suddenly emergency happens, bam, the water breaks, and hey, hon, the baby's coming. So if you ever think that you could possibly be in that situation or just want to stock up for, of course, preparedness or survival situations, I do have a first aid emergency deluxe labor and delivery OB kit. I know that's a mouthful. If you just go on altonfirstaid.com, you can look up labor and delivery or emergency deluxe labor or OB kit. Any of those words will work. You can find it. The first thing that's in there is a pre-packed sterile OB kit with instruments. Now, the interesting thing is that I found this kit. It is the same exact one that Dr. Bones, Dr. Alton, and I both used at the hospital that we practiced at when we delivered babies. It is the exact kit that we opened up with the main instruments and sterile items that we would need to deliver a baby. Things like a sterile basin with a lid, a baby blanket, infant head warmer, an umbilical cord clamp, drape to put underneath the woman who's delivering the baby, curved hemostat forceps, straight hemostats, a bunch of different instruments, scissors, gloves, a serrated needle holder in case you needed to sew the person up. Of course, we do include sutures for that too. a bulb syringe to clear the baby's nose and mouth at birth, a table cover so you don't get, you know, what she's delivering on messed up. OR towels, there's four of those. And what I've added in addition to that OB kit, headlamps, hand sanitizer, tons of gauze, some face masks, a full front coverage, face shield, a sterile gown in extra large, a cap for your hair, boot covers so that are knee high so you don't get your shoes dirty, extra pairs of sterile gloves, some a very long extended cuff, non-sterile gloves that you can do to check to see if she's dilating, a bunch of lubricating jelly because, of course, it's difficult to put your hand in there to check for dilation. You want to make it as comfortable as possible. Some nitrazine paper strips and a chart to tell if the water that's coming out is actually amniotic fluid, because some women will think they broke their water and they didn't, and this will tell you if it happened. Some Chucks pads, again, waterproof pads for underneath the person delivering. Some Betadine prep solution, a couple of scalpels just in case. Some alcohol preps, a thermometer. You want to see if everybody's staying healthy and not getting a fever. You can also use it for the baby after. A measuring tape to check for the length of the baby. You want to chart that. Some scissors. And then for after delivery, a perineal bottle to help the woman clean herself up. Some large pads, again, for the person who just delivered. Some rehydration packets. And a bottle of water purification tablets, because if you are in an emergency situation, you want to make sure that you're not giving her unsterile water, unclean water, we should say. So what are extra baby supplies for newborns and toddlers? There's been so much exploded in recent years. I do personally expect to have some grandbabies in 2027. So I personally have been thinking about how to find the best equipment to gather. I already have the LifeVac, which is what you referred to, Jed, in your question about the airway clearance. I have that. In fact, I also bought it for both of my daughters, who I expect to maybe have babies next year. It does come with a pediatric and an adult size, and it's basically a vacuum plunger that you're pulling back, and it's pulling through a quick vacuum plunge, pulling out possibly, hopefully, the stuck item, whether it's, you know, a quarter or a chunk of food or whatever it is that this person is choking on and can't breathe. So it pulls it out. I think it's very, very good to have on hand. Absolutely. I'm going to try to get through this faster because I got a lot of stuff. Okay. Definitely have your crib, your cradle, changing table, diaper pail, baby bathtub, stroller, car seat, rocking chair. Those are all easy to find. You can get great savings in thrift shops or online sales by parents who are done with their items. I personally purchased all of both of my children's furniture, stroller, car seats, and baby clothes in my favorite baby thrift store. I was able to bring the clothes that they either didn't wear or were in perfect condition, get some money from those when those sold, use that money to help buy things that were able to fit them or things that they needed. It was great. Love thrift stores. Can't say enough about them. Some are better than others, so check it out. But everything was in perfect condition, and I seriously saved thousands of dollars. So what else is new? Car seats with monitors that alert you that you are away from an occupied car seat. In other words, you have walked too far away from your baby or toddler. This helps prevent accidental deaths from kids left in hot cars. I love this, especially in a world with constant distraction, where it is probably easier to forget your child in the car than it used to be. Totally love this technology. Of course, baby video monitors have been around for years, but came out way after I had my kids. Seeing the baby anytime is always great and reassuring when they are sleeping or napping in another room. 100% a must-have. A sound machine isn't a bad idea, but why not just get an air purifier with a soft hum? This helps to keep the air clean and provide a soft sound to drown out outside noises that could wake your sleeping angel. special. Again, this is definitely on my list for my grandbabies. I'm not sure about the moving bassinets, but an electric slow-moving baby bouncer might help that colicky, gassy baby work the bubbles out and get a nap. Of course, the first line of working gas out is a nice belly and back massage and some leg movements. There are plenty of videos that I have watched, somehow have gotten on my YouTube homepage, to be able to learn how to do this through pediatricians or nurse practitioners, somebody who's qualified to teach you this. I've also seen some weighted baby belly warmers to soothe gas pain, and anything that helps to get gas out is on my list. One last thing that is super techy is the new breast pumps. I'm sure most of you men out there listening to this, you're like, what? They are wearable, they're separated, so they're not, you're not connected to a tube like Elsie the cow with a machine. They look a little bulky, but I really think that a large t-shirt should be able to hide them, so if you need to leave the house, you can. I have no idea if they make noise. They're supposed to. I think the technologies, they're kind of squishing, massaging, smushing the breast area to extract some milk that is then collected in this cup-like thing. Anyway, there's one for each of them. A breastfeeding mom can pump while moving around freely, which is a miracle for active moms. I love this idea. It probably helps moms breastfeed longer, which is, of course, awesome for the baby. Now, there are fancy bottle and pacifier washers that sit on your counter. To me, they're super expensive. It seems like kind of a waste. I really think that your dishwasher put on your sterilizer setting is probably just as good. And there's easier ways to sterilize bottles that have been around forever. A pot of boiling water. So I won't be buying one of these as it seems kind of redundant and, again, super expensive. Anyway, use your judgment. Do your own research. Some of the newer items might be more hype than help and break the bank. Enjoy your babies when they're little. It goes by at the blink of an eye. I have a tear in my eye saying that. I promise you this is 100% true. Enjoy every second, even when they're screaming. This is Amy Alton, again, from doomandbloom.net. I hope you enjoyed this segment.
So great stuff from Amy. And again, I would like some more questions that are specifically directed at Nurse Amy. Anything from the female perspective, obviously, that's medical would be ideal. Anything birth-related, because she is a certified midwife. Anything herbal related, because even though her and Joe are both very much rooted in allopathic medicine, they don't close off herbal stuff, and Amy's kind of the one more into the herbal and alternative treatments. So anything in any of those wheelhouses would be great for Amy. Send that email to me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, with TSPC in the subject line. I've occasionally get some, you know, some not really hate mail, just kind of like, hey man, what's up, about the fact that there's only, you know, one woman that regularly appears on the expert panel. I have had other women. They stopped doing it. Amy quit doing it. Not different Amy. There was Eric Strauss and a couple others. And I can't make people do this. This is a, you know, service level thing, and it people have to want to do it. Nicole does it. Amy will do it if you send her questions. I'll tell you what, though, if you're a gal and you're like, I think I can bring something to the table on the expert panel, email me and let me know about it. No matter what you email, always put TSPC in the subject line, and I will do my very best to answer your questions and handle your email, but that will just make sure I see it. If it's got TSPC in the subject line, even if I don't see it initially, if it gets filtered or something, I will find it before it ends up in the garbage folder, okay? All right, so let's do it. This is a question on, should I borrow against my Bitcoin? And I'm going to take this from an approach of, should I borrow against it, should I sell it, leverage it, etc., and what situation? This situation, though, I'm going to tell you out of the gate, I don't know why we're even talking about it, okay? But I will talk about, if you're going to take a gamble like this, how I might mitigate the risk. It says, hey, sir, I'm sorry, I'm prior Air Force, not Army. We say sir, ma'am, for everyone. Okay, well, anyway, my question is as follows. I'm 44. I have 30 paid-for acre homestead with an awesome home engineered and designed by a Vietnam-era veteran. He died, and I got the opportunity to purchase the amazing property. I've listened to you since 2010, and I've heard every Bitcoin breakout. My question is this. I have, through so much struggle, gained 1.25 Bitcoin. That's great. And you shouldn't, it doesn't sound like you have any need to budge from it, okay? Is it a completely dumbass move to leverage all that Bitcoin and get a loan from Lend to buy more? I am a plumber by trade and only 44. You told me to buy Bitcoin in like 2013. I thought it was ridiculous. Now should I leverage what I took so much hard work to get more? That question I can answer with an emphatic no. When you hear me talking about borrowing against Bitcoin, I am talking about end of working life with a large sum of money that you do not want to pay taxes on. And even then, that is a decision to be made pragmatically at that time. Okay? That's what it is. Okay. When would I borrow against Bitcoin if I were in a situation anything remotely like this? If I was trying to build something and I just could not get a loan for enough money to build, I might leverage Bitcoin, take a loan, make repayments on the loan as though I had gotten a loan as a mortgage or a building loan or something like that. I might do that. And the reason I might do that is if I fail to repay the loan, I'll lose the Bitcoin. Yeah, okay. If I sell the Bitcoin, pay capital gains tax, okay, and then do the project, I've definitely lost the Bitcoin. You see how that works? This is assuming you can service your debt load. You always have to look at debt, and you only take debt to build things or buy things that are appreciating assets or have specific monetary returns like inside a business, right? And that business could be you, Inc. So I don't have a problem a person borrowing money to buy a car when they need a specific quality of car to do their job every day, okay? So I'm not completely like Dave Ramsey, like you shouldn't even take a loan out on a car. I don't like loans on cars because they are depreciating assets, but if you look at the utility itself is the ROI in the right scenario. But when it comes to, like, I'm going to borrow against my Bitcoin and just buy more Bitcoin, I would say that if you're going to do that at all, and I'm not recommending you do, in fact, I'm saying not to, but if you're going to take that approach, you're looking at removing into a window where it would make the most sense, okay? But then I want you to think it through. What does winning look like? So let's say I've been saying that I expect the Bitcoin price to go lower before it recovers, and I expect that cycle low will probably come late in quarter three or early in quarter four, most likely somewhere around Thanksgiving, November-ish, and will be somewhere in the neighborhood of like $35,000 to $45,000. It could only get back to like, let's say, 50, but I don't see it not getting into that range. Like 48, 49, like that would be a pleasant surprise for me if it only fell that far. Either way, you can look at previous cycles. The timing that I'm giving you here, you know, it's always going to be somewhere between like 1 October and somewhere in January of this time of the cycle. It always has been. It probably will be again. So in that range would be when I would do this if I would do this at all. I still wouldn't do it. I'm not going to do it. And if you do it, then eventually you have to sell the new Bitcoin to pay off the loan that you have because you don't have enough Bitcoin to do some rolling credit retirement scheme. That's not what this is. And so then you have to pay capital gains on that, and then you get whatever's left. To me, that's a significant amount of risk with not a lot of mitigation to the risk. Now, let's take a different approach. Let's say you're like, I want to set a goal, and my goal is to become a double hole coiner, two Bitcoins. So you can buy 3/4 of a Bitcoin. I would be far more likely to take a loan on the property at a lower interest rate than you're ever going to get from Lend or Strike or anything on a Bitcoin-backed loan, at least right now, and use that to buy the Bitcoin. Now, you might have to bullshit a little bit about what you're doing with the money, but in general, if you have a 30-acre property with a house on it and you wanted to borrow somewhere in like a line of credit, like a HELOC of like $40,000, there's not a lot of question about what you're going to do with the money, right? That might be an option there. Now, I'm not saying to do that either, but a $40,000 mortgage, right, and you might get in a position where $40,000 will buy you an entire Bitcoin at 6%, on an asset that like would have to deeply underperform to not do at least 20% across 5 years. and making that payment to buy in during an accumulation trough. That, I would say, is a calculated risk that you have to determine for yourself, but that would make sense. Where I want to go with this now, though, is just a little bit broader on the question, though. When would I recommend selling? Like I always say, never sell your Bitcoin. And so did Michael Saylor. And then they sell like 32 Bitcoin out of like 800 and something thousand. And he's all Bitcoin. He said, no, we're just selling. He's going to rug you. Shut up. Right? That kind of nonsense. There are tactical reasons to sell Bitcoin. And there are pragmatic reasons to sell Bitcoin. If you were sitting on, let's say, 5 Bitcoin, and we were at a point where Bitcoin was at $100,000 a year, and you needed $200,000 to build a house, you might sell it, or you might borrow against it, or you might leverage part of it to build the house. All of those things would make sense. If you were in a bad situation, and you're sitting there with this big pot of Bitcoin money, and you're going to have major bad things happen in your life, like have your home repossessed, and you need like $10,000 now, and you can sell 12.5 of Bitcoin to cover your capital gains, and then take the 10 and then save your house? Yes! Of course you would! If you are sitting on Bitcoin that's isolated into UTXOs for this year, or for the last 2 years, and you can say, if I sell this Bitcoin, I sell it at a capital loss of $10,000. And since there's no wash rule, I can buy it immediately right back, record the loss, reset the basis, move that into its own new UTXO set, and start accumulating from here forward into a new UTXO set to run that tax strategy again. My question is, why haven't you done it already, except that we're not probably at the maximum loss you can take? But if you are in that situation right now, if you have isolated Bitcoin that you know, and if this is $500 loss, don't go through it. By the time you get done trading it and paying fees and transferring, you're going to wash. But if you can lose 10 grand and take that off your taxes, yeah, of course you do that. And that's something else people don't understand about corporations that have gone into the Bitcoin treasury mode. That sometimes when these companies sell Bitcoin, they're doing exactly that. And their losses might be extensive, but their paper losses, if they sell, let's say, 100 Bitcoin, and then next week they buy 200 Bitcoin, they're at a net 100 gain, but they have taken a loss that they couldn't have recorded if they didn't sell that grouped UTXOs. Do you understand what I'm saying? I hope so. So they're like this never sell mindset is never sell except, or let me put it a different way. When it comes to divesting of assets, the strongest long-term asset should be divested of last, because it's the greatest potential for future leverage, like a loan or appreciation and selling later to make more money. Okay, the shittiest asset goes first. And so when people say something like, I saw somebody yesterday put on X, stable coins are for hedging and Bitcoin is for spending. I'm like, well, you have that wrong. The shittiest asset you hold, right, that's actually considered an asset on a balance sheet is cash. It is a guaranteed loss of 2 to 4% minimum per annum, and it's actually a significantly higher burn rate on the power of inflation against your dollar. Okay. If you have some stocks in a company that's then that's a next level up still because it is an equity. Maybe it pays dividends or something. And then, like, what are the tax consequences? That also changes the qualification of what asset class you assign to it. So if I have an asset that I can sell without paying tax and an asset I can sell and I have to pay tax, if everything else is mostly equal, well, I'm going to sell the one that I'll have to pay tax on. See how that works? So you can't, it's not about sell never, it's about sell last and only sell if you have to, or if the logic as why to sell overrides the concept of the value of the asset later. Because if, let's say this was different, let's say he said, I want to build something on my property, and I have this 1.25 Bitcoin, which right now is worth about, what, 70 grand, 75 grand. So I'm going to sell my Bitcoin to build this thing. I'd be like, no. No, because I already know that this your 1.25 Bitcoin is going to be worth probably double in a year. And if we go out 5 years, then we're in a totally different world. And so, no, I don't want you to lose that appreciation. If it was, I'm going to lose what I have if I don't do it, then okay, then you do it. If it's, I don't even have a home yet, and this is my way to get into a home, then maybe. And then let's look at it a little bit more precisely. So, I think we need to start grouping, assets that we hold that we can liquidate into first, right? First liquidations, second liquidations, third level liquidations, and preferably never. And if we do that, we start making better decisions across the board. And that's really not a Bitcoin question. There could be a person holding no Bitcoin, and you would still have those classifications of assets. And you call the one in the fourth classification never money. And what never money really means is break glass in case of emergency only. That's what it means, right? You never pull the fire alarm in the public building until, well, there's a fire. So now that's why it's there. Any value you hold is there to insure against future needs. Right. And the longer we can defer, generally, a growing asset pays us a higher return. That's how to take a look at all this stuff. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. And I am going to one more time shill my book. We had no items of the day this week. Remember, you can always help us out doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. We will return to having items of the day next week. But this week, the item of the week, Laws of Life, Book 2. Now build the system for your life. And let me make one more appeal to you guys. And I've said this many times over 18 years. If you do not design your life, you will live the life that the systems of the society have designed for you. And the people that design those systems, those social engineers, are not thinking, how can I help Bill or Steve or Tammy or Sue? They're thinking, how can I help me? How can I help my goals, my agendas, in the macro moves that we create in society by dangling incentives that are perverse. And that's why an insurance company can say, this is how much it costs to insure you, because we don't think you're going to die till you're 78. And we believe that because reasons. And those reasons are an evaluation of your demographic, your age, your health, etc. And they are remarkably accurate with that. When's the last time you heard of an insurance company going out of business other than back in 2008 AIG, and that was insuring financial products? When have you heard an insurance company pushed to the edge of bankruptcy whose primary type of insurance is insuring human life? And the answer is you've never heard that. And that's because the numbers are solid, because the system does what it does, not what it claims to do, in the word of Stafford Beer. And someone else has put a maze up and stuck you in it. My books are designed to help you take a chainsaw to the walls in that maze, cut a hole in them, and design the dadgone life you want on your terms, not mine. And if that's not a good enough reason to give those books a shot, I don't know what would be. So check it out. Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, and then Laws of Life, Book 1, Second Edition, both available on Amazon. You can learn more at jackslaws.com, and of course, the website for the podcast, thesurvivalpodcast.com.
Biochar's a coral reef for the critters down deep. Bioreactor compost, turning scraps into gold. We keep ducks, do the work, fertilize, forage, keep the pest away. Regenerative magic on the good old Texas clay. Guns and hunting wisdom from the fathers before. Bitcoin in the wallet when the fiat hits the floor. AI on the horizon, but he keeps his boots on the ground. Living off the land while the whole world spins around. Even on vacation up in Estes Park Snow, he's up at 5 a.m. writing Laws of Life, don't you know? Book one, ditch the system, design it your own way. A mill, build the system, work it every day. The preparedness ain't crazy, it's just being grown. Responsible adulting in the world we've been shown. Charlie and Max on patrol, food, forest, and bloom. Community learning how to thrive with some room. Redneck, hippie, duck farmer, down on. While he lends a helping hand, did you see?
strike. Redneck hippie duck farmer. That's the way to be. Whoa. Jack Spurko, y'all. Set us free.